Alan Crane Productions, in association with the Emergent Life Studio, present the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for autumn semester 2025. Today, capital budgeting. This will be the last of the spreadsheets that you will have for this course. And again, this one is very useful for time-saving purposes. And I will carry this obviously into Wednesday's lecture, since we do have a quiz today, and that will begin in a while. But before we do anything else, let's look at the numbers and have a see if there's anything worth looking at. Now, first things first is that this was definitely a mild day on the street. As you can see, the Dow was down almost 0.5%, but then the S&P actually made it up 0.25%, and then the NASDAQ was up somewhat more than 0.5%. It's not a spectacular day. It's just there's a little more positive news than bad news, but you're going to see something here in a minute. Matter of fact, let me show you right now. If you look at the sector map is telling us that the only reason there was a minorly positive day was because of the technology sector. Well, now, I'm trying to look there to see what, well, yeah, there's one, a couple of others, but most of the weight of the bull that part of the day was the technology sector, and the rest of the market was showing a lot of weakness. And that's a telling sign right there that even though it looks like there's a bull market going on, the technology sector, which is a very large sector, is carrying the water for that bull market. The rest of the market is showing more and more signs of a bear market. So it's kind of, you decide where your investments are going to be. Are you going to go wide across many sectors, or are you going to try to hold into that one sector that is doing so well? And as I told you last week, the technology sector is going to stay bullish, simply because that is where the future economy is going to be, is in artificial intelligence replacing people, is in cloud computing, is in other parts of the computer world, the cyber world. And the rest of the market is going to be suffering a lot, especially in the sense that where we have a lot of layoffs beginning to happen over the next 5 years, because people will be replaced by artificial intelligence systems, robotic systems, and all that. The question will be, how can the economy sustain itself if there isn't any money? People don't have enough money to buy stuff. And if they're buying stuff in a high inflation environment, well, it's going to get worse and worse for the average person, even if the market itself looks very good, being carried along by this constant rapid globalization, globalized growth of artificial intelligence and to other technologies. So it does have its worrying signs. And coming back up here for a minute, just to look around, you can see that, of course, you have a look at the rest of the world, which is useful to do to see if there's other places that are in better shape. But, Nikkei did a really good job today. I mean, it was up quite a bit. Now, that's significant because there had been rumblings of recessionary pressures in Japan, but Tokyo seems to be shaking those off right now, and that's good for them. Maybe not for us, but it's good for them. And of course, Hang Seng is just on a quiet roll upward as China begins to dominate the world's economic platform, along with some other countries. But European markets look good. Actually, CAC was down a little bit. It sort of gave up there at one point. So did the FTSE. These aren't large numbers. The London was down just a small amount, 0.16%. And you look over at the Paris Exchange, down 0.14%. So these aren't any kind of a major bull bear fall off. But if we go over here, now gold is above $4,000 an ounce right now. That seems to be where it's comfortable, is right there. It's not running toward 5,000 like it was a while back, but it's certainly a lot higher than it was early in the year. So it's found a happy place, and right now I don't know that it's going to make any more really explosive moves upward or downward for a while. But ultimately it may start to move up again, perhaps before the end of the semester, as more and more warning signs start to show up of recession. And of course, crude is still sitting there down low 60s, so we're not going to get any high prices on gasoline for a long time to come. But just one last look at the energy sector, the sector map here, you can see that, yeah, it is actually overall a bear day, but the look of the bull day is coming from the dominance of the technology sector, which is going to be green more than it is red, even into a recession. It will give this a false appearance because so much of the market cap of the world is now in these companies in the technology sector, not in the companies that are more the bread and butter of the world. Let me show you. NVIDIA had news today, or was it yesterday? Well, let's try that again. Try NVIDIA. There we go. And another roaring day upward, up to more than 2.5%. And the key here is, look at that market cap. That market cap is just staggering. $5 trillion just in one company. That's why that green sector, that it's just dominating all of the numbers, these high technology companies. And so the rest of the sectors could be dying, but it looks like overall the economy is really doing good. And it's because of this insane concentration of capital in the high technology companies, like NVIDIA and some of the others that are up there in the high end. Another one that is in the high technology sector is Google, Alphabet, the companies they called Alphabet. But if you look at that one, up 1%, and that one is sitting at, good Lord, is that a two and a half, or is that a three? Oh, $3.5 trillion. I mean, they're just dominating the valuation of all of the companies of the earth, these few at the very top of the food chain in this business. And so we could look at some of the others like Apple. I don't know if Apple is still above a trillion. Oh, well, yeah, it is. $4 trillion. Just in these companies, just a small little clutch of companies, they are worth so much. So that, like I said, and I'll emphasize this one more time, is that the economy as a whole could be on the skids. But because of the health and wealth of these technology companies, the picture is a lot different than what it is for the average person. Let me show you, just to emphasize this a little bit. A company like Colgate-Palmolive, all of those basics that we do have, its market cap is a tiny $60 billion. Another company there on that level would be Colgate-Palmolive, Well, the retail sector, look at something like Walmart, WMT. These are huge companies. Huge companies. But when you look at them, that one doesn't even make it, it's not even a $1 trillion company. So one of the very biggest possible retail companies in the world. Here it is. It isn't, doesn't even make it to $1 trillion. And so that's what I'm talking about, is the things that are actually important to the average household, the average business. Those kinds of things don't make much of a dent in the overall market's performance, which is pretty much being driven by these high technology companies that we do not really need nor experience on a day-to-day basis. Well, we do experience them, but they are not basic necessities of life, like your soap, your toilet paper, your food. Some of the giants, like, for example, in agriculture, ConAgra, CAG. Tiny company, ADM, the famous supermarket of the world, Archer Daniels Midland. Whoops. The broker of commodities all over the world, only $29 billion. That's what I'm talking about. We're seeing a biased picture of the true state of the world, because the technology sector, which is growing rapidly and will continue to grow for many decades to come, is overshadowing everything by a mile. Okay, that's where we go with this. And I'm going to let that go for the day, just to give you and pick it up back up on Monday as we talk about more and better, more of this. Now, let me take you over, and we're going to go, first of all, and I'll start the attendance radar here for you, too, in just a minute. But first things first, I want you to go in to your files folder in Canvas, and you go down to your spreadsheets, and I promise, I think I said the last one was the last one, but I forgot this one. Go into your spreadsheets. And your last one is called NPV and IRR. And you download it. Now, the sheets in here, there are actually a number of them. I tend not to pay too much attention to crossover. I'll talk about it a little bit, but the big one is NPV and IRR, and then the payback period, which is an old method, and I'll talk about it here in a little bit. And then this one is so simple, but it is so used in business, especially in smaller businesses. This one, the break-even analysis, I do it all the time. Every company I've ever consulted for did break-even analysis. It's just so popular, and yet it's kind of flawed and it's simplistic, but it sure is nice to have. But the big 800-pound gorilla is the NPV and the IRR, which is the one I've set this up so that you can do a project up to 10 years in length using my sheets here. So let me do some background on this to start it. And I've mentioned this before. I've talked about this historical perspective, but I'll bring it up again just kind of emphasize why we do this. There is a long history of projects going back all the way to the beginnings, maybe even before, quote unquote, civilization. People have engaged in commerce. We even have evidence that our predecessors, the Neanderthals, seem to have had some commercial aspects of their society, where they would produce something and then they would trade it for something else in barter systems with other tribes. Possibly there was even tribal transactions between Neanderthals and the Homo sapiens. We don't know that, but there's some kind of evidence that we see humans have tools that were more Neanderthal, and Neanderthals seem to have tools that were more of their cousins. Anyway, so it's been going on for a long time, and it certainly was happening all the time. By the time we get to the great first civilizations, like in Sumeria. But there was it got to be kind of a frenzied pitch when commerce really picked up a fever pace. Now, there was a lot of commercial interactions going on before this, but you get into the Middle Ages, and there was this interest in commercial activity between the Western Europe and the East, specifically China, the Silk Road, traveling clear over there and bringing back stuff to over here and selling it over here. Now, this had been going on for a very long time, but in the Middle Ages, there was sort of a difference. Something happened, and we'd seen this before, but it picked up quite a bit of pace. We had a period in the Middle Ages when life was kind of good. We began to see elements of a little bit freer society. We even saw some people who were not freemen who had owned land, and that should not be part of a feudal system, but we saw it in some of the census records. And they did keep awfully big, good census records in some parts of England and Europe. But anyway, we had a great period of warmer weather in the 1200s, and it was pretty nice, and you began to see more loosening of economic conditions and a little bit of class mobility. Not much to speak of, but there was a little bit. And then the weather turned really bad. I mean, it was like a mini ice age almost, and it was just lousy. There are some who say, well, this was caused by a volcano on the other side of the world that clouded the atmospheres and made it cold and all that kind of stuff, whatever. It got bad. It got nasty. And interestingly enough, when times get nasty, the wealthy class begins to consolidate its power and its position, its wealth. And for the centuries, Western Europe and England had, Great Britain, had a system of feudalism. There was a class, lower class of people. Sometimes you call them serfs, sometimes villeins, and other names for them. They lived on the lands of the wealthy, the lords and ladies, the nobility. And this is how you just lived your life there. Generations of these serfs and villeins would live on the land. They would work the land. They would give some of it to the lord of the land, and then they would keep some for themselves. Really, just a normal, that was how life was. You were either a wealthy class or you lived on the land of a wealthy class. Well, when this dire weather with bad crop harvests started to show up, the wealthy did something we had seen in other times, in ancient times. They engaged in what's called an enclosure movement. They started kicking the serfs and the villeins off the land. You get off the land. You come back for the planting and you come back for the harvest, but otherwise, we don't want you on our land anymore. They start chasing them away. And we've seen that before in history, and we may be seeing the first signs of it in modern times. However, this enclosure movement caused an exodus of people, poor people, miserable, hungry, dying, sick people on the roads. And as happens in times when there are a lot of poor people on the roads trying to find a place, they start the stories about some places where there are many jobs, there's a land of plenty. During the Great Depression, there were all these, this talk about the land of milk and honey being California. California is where we ought to go. We're just going to have to get off this land and head out to California. The Okies were one of those groups with the Oklahoma people. And there were Kansas, Nebraska, even up as far as Wisconsin and places like that. They started heading west. Well, this is what was happening during this Middle Ages crisis. The people who had been thrown off the lands of the wealthy started moving toward the cities because they heard there were jobs there. They heard that there was food there. They heard that there were opportunities there. And these were by the millions on the roads. They were walking the roads, begging on the roads. They were giving birth on the roads, taking their pisses and their shits on the road, and crawling under bridges and against trees to die on the roads. And as they moved toward the cities, they got closer and closer together. And as they moved on the roads, they were followed by the rats. And the rats were carrying the fleas, and the fleas were carrying the plagues. The first of the plagues was the pneumonic plague. It was one that killed the weak and weakened the strong. And then came the black plague, the bubonic plague. And that one was a killer. People were weakened, their immune systems were already damaged from the pneumonic plague, and then they were hit with the bubonic plague, and they died in droves. As they compressed into the cities, the infection rate skyrocketed because they were in close proximity to each other. There was sewage, there were rats, there were the fleas, there were all the other vectors of diseases of all kinds, not just bubonic plague, but parasitic plagues and other viral and bacterial plagues. And a lot of them died. By some estimates, as much as 33% of the population of Europe and England were killed in a period of maybe a decade. And this wasn't just a human crisis, it was also an environmental crisis because there was no one to bury the dead. And so they lay for days rotting, creating even more catastrophe. And there were religious prescriptions against incinerating the bodies, so they would just have to lie there until there were a few people strong enough to drag the thousands of corpses to holes that they dug in the ground. That's how grim it was. We really don't want to go back there, but then again, history has a tendency to go in cycles. Anyway, after it was over, the plague began to let up through natural immunity, through the death of the weak, and the survival of the strong, and something odd began to happen, something very strange. The people who remained had much greater power, and they had a thirst for living well. When you come out from your apocalypse bunker and you look around and everyone is dead, well, you'll be sad, but then also you will realize that there is more for you. And there aren't as many people to push you around. And if they push you around, you can walk and find someone else who won't push you around. This was the experience that began to show up when we saw these revolutions in style. People used to wear tunics. They started tying them up. They started wearing a little bit more color to themselves. They sought to work in unison with others who knew what they did, knew the things they did, like plumbers, masons, things like that. And something inside of the society began to shift. The power structure began to devolve. You even had demands for the religious text to be written in common language instead of the effete medieval Latin. And then something else began to happen too. Because they wanted more of everything, they started wanting that stuff that was unusual, strange. They wanted to hear stories, they wanted to eat foods, they wanted to feel fabrics and wear fabrics that just weren't available locally. And so the explorers, like Marco Polo, they would have been going that way to China. There was then a question, well, what would happen if we went the other way around the world? No, no one believed the world was flat. They knew there was, you could go the other way. They just didn't know what was out there. But there were other things that were happening too. There had been a wall. Essentially, no one had gone to Rome. Everyone said Rome was fell hundreds and hundreds of years ago. There's nothing down there but ruins. Well, a couple of intrepid adventurers took risks going through the mountains, facing the god-awful elements and the bandits and the tribes along the way, and they got to Rome. And they came back, and they had stories to tell. One of them was Geoffrey Chaucer, probably the greatest poet in English history, but he's not well known because he spoke in Middle English instead of Shakespeare's early modern English. But here's what he said. Everyone said, oh, did you see all those ruins? I'll bet there's no one there. Oh no, Rome came back to life. What? Oh yeah, you should see it. There is all this writing that isn't just religious texts. It talks about things like romance and adventure and war. It is so cool. And there are these artists. They're actually showing people the way they are. They're not little angels with halos around their heads. They're physical human beings. There are these sculptors who are actually making sculptures of nude human bodies with all their muscles proudly showing and everything about them. And, oh, there are these foods down there, too. You wouldn't believe what's going on. Well, people said, oh, my God, we want this. And that was what was propelling those guys who said, we need to get over to the New World. Rather, we need to get over to China. And we need to do it in a faster way, more efficiently, than those guys who keep taking the Silk Road and all those roads over to China. We need a way to get over there fast and clean. And that was what was driving those explorers like Christopher Columbus. They were running around trying to find the capital to do this wild thing. And it wasn't just Columbus. There were others, too, that were running around begging for money from rich nobles. In fact, Christopher Columbus, his brother, I think it was his brother, found a rich guy, a rich family, and for some of the capital that he needed. And that guy said, yeah, I'll do it, but I'm going to command the ship that I pay for. You need three ships? I'll pay for one of them, and I'm the commander of it. Columbus said, okay, that's cool. We'll do, can do. Well, they went over there, and they came back. And it was just a total, literally a freak out at the fairs where the wares that were brought from other lands would show up in France, in England, in Spain. There were these fairs at different times of the year. And it was just a frenzy. What is that food you've got there? What are those fabrics? And all that kind of stuff. So they kept yelling, more, more, more. In other words, there was a demand, a latent demand was turning into a real demand to buy that stuff that was coming from overseas. Now, obviously, you would want to go over, get more and more of it to bring back, to increase your revenues, and to make a profit from this. So you had to have investment. In other words, you had to draw capital into the equation. Well, going to the nobles wasn't a good idea because a lot of those kings and queens were actually not that. They had the appearance of wealth, but they were literally begging for money from rich families. They were taxing the hell out of their everyone, the poor people. So they really didn't have much of the money, but there were a lot of resources beginning to come online. Especially families, like there was a family that had a monopoly on the salt mines around Europe, and they were a source of money. The Medicis in Italy had a lot of money, and they were willing to put it into these adventures, except for a little problem. They wanted to know how much they were going to make, how much it was going to cost, and what risk was going to be taken in the process. Funny how that works. The same things that we talk about in my class here is what they were asking for. Show us the numbers. Well, that brings in a completely different line into the story, and I think I brought this one up. There was no real consolidated way in Western civilization to represent, you know, income, operating expenses, and all that kind of stuff. And how would you do it in a rigorous fashion so that you could look at one possible adventurer's projections and see the same things as far as structure goes to another one's projections? Well, enter a completely bizarre aspect. There was a monastery in Italy where there was a monk. He was had a vow of silence for his whole life. He did his prayers, he did his other jobs of the monastery, but in the evenings he designed something extraordinary. He designed a double ledger accounting system. His name was Father Pacioli. Pacioli actually devised our system that you just learned in your accounting courses. That's his. It was out of nowhere. And then they had the capital sources, the surplus economic units, said, okay, we want to see it in this system. We want to see what your numbers are, your projected revenues, what you need, the costs, how much capital it was going to take to make this project happen, an initial investment, and then the free cash flows that would come after it. They didn't use those terms, but that's exactly what they were looking for. And so we come to this era when we began to look at what's called capital budgeting. Capital budgeting. Where you figure out how to budget capital. How much initial investment? What are the free cash flows that will arise from it? What's the length of the project? And is it a go or a no-go based upon some mechanism of analysis? Now, the first one that came along, and it came along early, I've seen with my own eyes what appears to be this first system in some documents from the 1600s. And it was all over the place by the 1700s. And as a consultant, I even saw it to this day. In fact, a survey of businesses about, it's probably been 6 or 7 years ago, asked businesses, which of the three capital budgeting analysis systems do you use? The first one is that ancient payback period method. And I knew from my experience that it was still being used because I had small companies that just assumed that's how you do it. It's flawed. It's really flawed, but it does kind of work. Now, the next one is, these are the two modern techniques, net present value. And then the third technique, which is the sort of like the brother of net present value, is called the internal rate of return technique. Internal rate of return technique. Now, you usually designate the internal rate of return as IRR and the net present value technique as NPV. Bizarrely, payback period was, I don't have the numbers right now, but it was something like 25% of all companies still use payback period. It's ancient, it's flawed, but it is very simple to use. And that's why a lot of, to this day, you have a lot of companies still using it. I saw it in my consulting work. Now, these two are the modern methods, net present value and internal rate of return. fortunately, together, the majority of companies do use those now. However, interestingly enough, they are not equally strong, as you'll see probably in my lecture on Wednesday. The internal rate of return method carries in it a slight flaw that can explode in your face in some project analyses. The net present value is always clean. It always gives you an answer that you can rely on. But strangely enough, the internal rate of return method is somewhat more popular than the NPV method. Why that is, it's hard to say. But you see, the one thing we do want to make sure is with students like you, you're going to be the leaders. When you go out there, you're going to know the best practices, most modern methods, against which you will have the backdrop of the company's culture, what they use. And of course, if they're using payback period method, you're not going to be able to start there and in their first meeting say, excuse me, you shouldn't be using payback period. You don't have that power. But as time goes on and you bake yourself into a rise in the corporate environment, you'll be able to bring these methods in to more common practice than they are at this time. And maybe even make sure that you know that if the company is using internal rate of return, it would be good if they would consider the NPV method, at least do both of them, knowing as you will that internal rate of return does have some flaws in it. So that's kind of the backdrop, is that I send you out there armed with the best modern methods. Will you be able to get the world to see them right away? Obviously not. But you rise in power, as most of you will. You will be able to infect the corporate decision-making process with these best practices as we understand them in 2025. And I will caution you on something interesting in the age of artificial intelligence. With ChatGPTs, you don't even have to tell them. You can just say, do the NPV, or net present value, or the internal rate of return, and they will do them for you. The problem with that is that oftentimes, unless you really put guardrails on them, they'll give you wrong answers. It's just how ChatGPTs are. Unless you discipline them and teach them how to behave, like you're doing with a toddler, they'll just go off on their own and they'll invent a number. And then they can even argue with you. I've had a few where I was retraining them, and they argued with me about it. They, no, this is the way, I'm doing exactly what you're telling me to. No, you're not. You don't get mean with them, because someday they'll be able to turn us into their food, but you say no. You explain, if it's giving you wrong answers, then you explain to it what it's doing wrong, or tell it to find your flaw in your calculations and correct it to the point where you get my answer. That's why you need to have one or two of your own to test on the ChatGPT before you set it loose on its own, because they can give you wrong answers, especially when you get into this a little bit more high-powered finance. They'll just keep spitting out wrong answers to you. So that's your backdrop. Let me explain payback period to you. Actually, no. I will explain it all to you on Wednesday. What I'm going to do now is have you kick in your attendance radar, and then you should be able to climb into the test. And when you're finished with that, as usual, after a quiz, that's all I have for you today. I thank you.